calling to him from the front porch of their house.
"I sure did," the man named Ernie replied to the woman's question. "Wasn't that the weirdest thing? I've never seen white vegetables before. Didn't know what to think. Anyway, I put them in the pail with the weeds."
"We've got to find them," Chester whispered urgently. "But Chester, I thought you wanted to follow that crowd of people."
"First things first," he replied.
The man picked up the full garbage pail and carried it to a pickup truck parked in the driveway. I noticed that the truck contained several other pails filled with clippings.
"I'm going to take this stuff down to the dump myself," the man proclaimed. "No sense waiting for the sanitation men when there's so much of it."
"Good idea," his wife agreed. "Wait a minute. I'll give you the garbage from the party last night. We may as well get rid of that at the same time."
She went inside the house as the man hoisted the garbage pail over the side of the truck. "How are we going to find those vegetables now?" I asked. "They're somewhere inside one of those pails."
"Obviously, we're going to have to look for them."
"But how?" I protested. "When? The man's leaving for the dump any minute."
"And guess who's going with him?"
"Oh, now wait a minute.
Are we going for a ride, Pop?"
Howie piped up.
"That's the general idea."
"Oh, boy. Now hold on there, Chester," I said. "I didn't bargain for a sightseeing tour of the town dump in today's activities. Besides, you know I get carsick. I'll stay here and look for Benicula."
Chester wasn't having any of my arguments.
"It'll be faster with all three of us looking," he said. "Besides, the trip to the dump can't take all that long. We'll be there and back before you know it."
The man was inside the truck, starting the engine, as his wife emptied the extra garbage over the side.
"See you soon, dear,"
she said, as he started to pull out of the driveway. She went back into the house, and Chester said,
"Now's our chance. Let's go."
Chester and I jumped up and over the edge of the truck in one gazelle-like movement. But Howie, who lacks the agility, not to mention the legs, of a gazelle, succeeded only in falling over backward onto the gravel. Frantically, he scampered back and forth by the side of the truck, yipping his head off.
"Shh! Harold, get him," Chester advised.
I leaned over the side and scooped poor Howie up by the scuff of his neck, just as the truck turned into the street. With a flip, he landed in the garbage pail next to me.
"This has been a great day for my mouth," I commented, trying to spit out the dog and cat hairs that coated my tongue. "Do you suppose we could stop for a lemonade?"
Chester gave me a look.
"Let's start digging," he said.
Just then, Howie's head popped up over the garbage pail. Strands of spaghetti cascaded over his forehead and ears as tomato sauce ran down the sides of his nose.
"Boy,"
he said, licking his chops and catching the rivulets of sauce with his tongue.
"That must have been some party they had last night."
Chapter 5. The Dog in the Green Toupee.
"Come on, Howie," Chester said. "Quit clowning around. We've got serious business to take care of."
"Who's clowning?"
asked Howie, licking his lips. He ducked back down into the garbage pail, his voice calling out from its depths.
"There's some great stuff in here. Corn cobs, melon rinds, apple strudel, whipped cream. Oh, and here's a nice, big, juicy..."
And then all I could hear was a loud crunch.
Chester sighed heavily. "Harold," he muttered, "could you do something about Howie, please? I believe I'm about to have heart palpitations."
I looked at my friend Chester and shook my head.
"No one ever said it was easy being a father," I commented. "Very funny," he replied. "Now would you please ask the kid to knock it off?"
I must admit my mouth was watering for a little of that apple strudel, but I decided it would have to wait. After all, my digestive tract would know no peace with Chester chomping at the bit the way he was. I knocked on the side of the pail and entreated Howie to remove himself. Reluctantly, he agreed.
"Can you help me get out of here?" he asked. "I think my foot's stuck in a ketchup bottle or something."
"Here," I said, jumping up against the side of the pail. "I'll pull you out. Just grab my neck." Chester backed away. "Be careful you don't pull the whole thing," he was saying, when my foot slipped on a banana skin Howie must have thrown out earlier.
"Whoops,"
I cried. I fell back as Howie and the garbage pail came tumbling down. Howie flew past my head. the pail's contents spilled all over the floor. And Chester. And me. Nervously, I shot a glance to the front of the truck to see if the driver had heard the crash, but he must have been playing his radio really loudly, because he didn't even turn around. When I turned back, Chester was staring at me. A watermelon rind sat on the top of his head like an oversized beret. His face was plastered with seeds.
"Gee, it looks like you've grown some freckles since I saw you last," I joked.
Chester wasn't in a laughing mood. He shook off the remains of the watermelon and suggested I do the same with the tea bags and coffee grounds that adorned my head. Howie, meanwhile, was contentedly chewing on a steak bone that had landed at his side.
"Any more where that came from?" I asked eagerly.
Howie didn't reply. He was too busy slurping over his find.
"Later, Harold, later," Chester muttered. "Right now we've got to see if we can find those vegetables."
He gazed into the overturned pail.
"Wait a minute," he cried suddenly. "There, next to those cans. Doesn't that look like a..." "I'm going in to take a look around. Harold, start checking the other pails."
And he disappeared from sight. With Chester out of the way, I was all set to root through the garbage that was strewn about to see if I could find something good to eat, when the truck suddenly swerved to the right and my stomach lurched to the left. I groaned. "There's nothing like a sudden case of car sickness," I thought, "to knock the appetite right out of you."
"Boy, this bone is great," Howie remarked just then. "It could use a little seasoning, though. Would you pass that jar of peanut butter, Uncle Harold?"
As the truck veered around a bend in the road, I moaned and batted the peanut butter jar toward Howie. Nauseated, I made my way toward a still-standing garbage pail and began snooping around. What do dead vegetables smell like, I wondered, as I poked my nose under the lid. The odor of freshly cut grass greeted my nostrils.
"Oh, no," I thought, a sudden rash of panic running through me. "My hay fever. I could feel that familiar tingle in the end of my nose."
The lid of the garbage pail flipped over as hundreds of blades of grass sailed into the air. After riding the currents for a brief, liberating fling, they tumbled down, one after the other, to nestle into their new home on the top of my head, sticking to the wet spot the coffee grounds had so recently made ready for them. Howie looked up from his repast and chuckled at what he saw.
"Gee, Uncle Harold," he said, "you'd make a great title for a spy novel. The Dog in the Green Toupee."
"Choo!"
I replied. Chester emerged from the pail just then, dragging in his teeth a stalk of celery.
"Boy," I said, trying to shake off the stubbornly clinging grass, "you smell terrible. What'd you get into in there, anyway?"
"You don't smell like a rose yourself," he said, dropping the celery. "Anyway, it doesn't matter what else is in there. The important thing is that I've found the white vegetables, or some of them at least. I'll bring out the rest, and then we can get to work."
Chester withdrew once again into the inner recesses of the pail, only to return several times with various specimens of vegetable specters. He laid them out neatly on the floor of the truck, his appraising eye passing over each in turn.
"How do you know that celery's one of the culprits?" I asked. "After all, celery is white to begin with."
"Sometimes," Chester said, "and sometimes it's green. Anyway, we can't be too careful. We wouldn't want to leave a killer celery stalk on the loose, would we?"
"Well, I hope you're right," I muttered. "If not, we may be getting a phone call from the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Vegetables."
"Thank goodness we found them in time," Chester went on with a sigh. "Howie, bring the toothpicks over here."
Howie glanced up from his bone, a look of bewilderment on his face.
"Toothpicks?"
he asked.
"Yes."
Howie, his lips covered with peanut butter, smiled weakly.
"I think I forgot them, Pop. I must have left them back at the garden, behind Max's house. Gee, I'm sorry.
The tip of Chester's tail tapped the floor nervously.
"Great," he said. "That's just great. Now what are we going to do?"
"Well," I replied, "before your heart palpitations start up again, I think I have a solution. Inside that pail over there," I went on, indicating the one that had exploded its contents all over my head, "there are a lot of twigs.
They're a little big for the job, but I don't see any reason we couldn't use them instead of toothpicks.
Chester considered my suggestion, and after a moment's reflection, nodded solemnly.
I like it, he said. It's natural, organic, back to the earth. Thoreau would have been proud of you.
Well, I wasn't sure what Thoreau had to do with it. In fact, I wasn't sure who Thoreau was, though I had a sneaking suspicion he'd once pitched for the Yankees. But I decided to accept Chester's response with modest appreciation. After all, a compliment from Chester is something like a shooting star. Rare. And if you blink, there's a good chance you'll miss it.
We picked out several likely candidates for statehood from among the twigs, and with great ceremony, drove them through the hearts of the vampirical veggies. We were admiring our work when all at once we heard a loud bang.
They're shooting! Howie cried. He covered his ears with his paws. Don't let them get me, Uncle Harold, he whimpered. I'll give them back their steak bone. I didn't mean to take it. Honest, I didn't. Just don't let them shoot me. I'm too young to die. I'm too nice to die. I'm too me to die.
Will you cut that out? Chester snapped. Nobody's shooting.
How can you be sure? I asked. Maybe there's a law against stabbing vegetables with twigs in the back of a moving pickup truck.
I lowered myself to the floor, getting out of the line of fire. I became aware that our ride had become very bumpy, and that we were slowing down. The truck pulled off the road and rolled unevenly to a complete stop. Before we could figure out what was going on, the driver jumped out and walked to the rear end of the truck.
Great, I heard him mumble. A flat. Just what I needed.
He lowered the tailgate.
Well, he went on, I'll just get the spare and... Well, 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 what have we here?
I looked up to see him staring straight at me. I tried to smile.
Where did you come from? He asked, startled.
Don't ask me, I thought. They're the experts on reproduction.
He stood there scratching his head.
Boy, what a mess you've made. Come on, get out of there. Let's go.
He swatted at us, indicating in his unsubtle way that the ride was over. For my part, it didn't take much persuading. I was relieved our little adventure had come to an end. Between the garbage and the hay fever and the car sickness, I was delighted to say goodbye to the truck and feel solid ground underfoot once again. As the three of us walked along the highway toward town, I said to Chester, "I'll be glad to get home."
"So will we all," Chester said wearily. "So will we all. But first—" "Yeah, yeah, I know," I said. "Destiny calls." "Exactly."
"Harold! Chester!"
a distant voice cried out. We stopped in our tracks. "Chester," I said, shaking slightly, "did you hear—"
"Yes, I—"
"Harold!"
the voice called again.
"Chester!"
Chester's eyes went wild.
"It isn't Max this time," he said. "It must be."
Then we heard the sound of someone laughing. We turned and saw Howie standing several feet behind us, a grin plastered on his face from ear to ear.
"Boy, Pop! Boy, Uncle Harold! You really fell for it!"
Chester and I looked at each other.
"Harold, can't you do a better job of keeping the kid in line?" Chester asked me as we resumed walking.
"I don't know, Chester," I replied. "He's your son." And Howie kept chuckling all the way into town. Chapter 6 The Transformation of Toby and Pete. By the time we reached the sign that said, "Welcome to Centerville," the place that people who live here call home, I was feeling better. There's something about a leisurely walk in the country, regardless of the circumstances, that invigorates the soul and reminds one that the simple pleasures are the best. After all, what could be more gratifying than a stroll down a country lane with your two best friends? even when the country lane is in reality a four-lane superhighway, complete with speeding cars and bleating horns, and one of your two best friends is getting a migraine trying to read the writing on the spinning hubcaps, while the other is ranting and raving about killer vegetables, and all three of you reek of eau de garbage. One must learn to overlook such minor drawbacks and take one's enjoyment where one can. Which is exactly what I was doing late that Saturday morning when Chester suddenly went into his stalking position. He scampered behind a rock, wiggled his rear end, and flattened his head so that no one on the other side could see him. "What's up?" I asked innocently, sauntering up to his side. Howie joined us a second or two later. "Let me guess. You've just seen a suspicious-looking string bean hanging out in the cabbage patch.
And you're waiting to see if the rice squad shows up."
Howie chimed in. Chester was not amused.
"Shh!" he admonished us.
"But what?"
"Over there," Chester said, "across the road. You want suspicious-looking, Harold? I'll give you suspicious-looking. What's wrong with that picture?"
My gaze drifted to the house across the road. I saw that in its front yard was gathered a small group of kids. One of them was standing apart from the others. Though I looked them over carefully, I was unable to discern anything peculiar going on. When I said nothing, Chester went on.
"Their clothes, Harold," he said. "Look at what they're wearing. I ask you, is that normal?"
I saw then that two of the kids were wearing long black capes, the one standing alone and another who seemed to be pushing several others forward. When I looked more closely, I was in for an even greater surprise.
"That's Toby and Pete," I cried. "Not so loud," Chester replied. "I know that's Toby and Pete, but I don't want them to hear us."
"Why don't you want them to hear us?" I asked.
"Yeah, Pop, why don't you want them?"
"I have my reasons," Chester said. "Come on, we've got to get closer and listen in. Follow me."
I must admit, it did seem a little strange for Toby and Pete to be wearing capes, but having lived in a house with two normal, active boys for many years, I had come to expect the unexpected. Heck, I'd lived with Chester for many years, and if that hadn't taught me to expect the unexpected, nothing ever would. Stealthily, we crept along the edge of the road, and when we saw that no cars were coming, hurried across to find a good hiding place behind a rhododendron bush. I could see clearly then that it was Pete, who was standing off to one side, and Toby, who was pushing the others toward him. What we overheard was curious. Very curious indeed.
"Here they are, Master,"
Toby said, shoving several of the boys and girls forward.
"I caught them snooping around,"
Pete said.
"You did, eh? Good work.
Now, what shall we do with them, huh?"
One of the kids in the group spoke up angrily.
"We didn't mean anything, honest. We just wanted to know what was going on. We didn't think..."
"You didn't think is right,"
Pete shot back, swirling his cape over his arm.
"You don't know who I am, do you? Well, you'll find out. You'll find out. Take them away."
Toby started to push the kids toward the back of the house as they cried,
"No! No! No!"
"What do you think is going on?" I whispered to Chester. "It's not like Peter and Toby to be so rough."
"Maybe they're just playing,"
Howie suggested.
"I don't think so," Chester replied softly. "There's something too serious in their manner."
We noticed then that Pete was telling Toby to wait a moment.
"Hello, what's this?"
Chester asked as his ears lifted. Pete was pointing at one of the girls in the group.
"Don't take that one," he instructed Toby. "Leave her with me."
"Me?"
the girl cried out in alarm.
"No, please, I beg you."
Toby pushed the girl forward, and she fell on her knees. He left with the other kids, disappearing around the corner of the house. Pete stared at the girl for a long, tense moment.
"What is your name?" he asked at last.
"Hilda,"
the girl replied, her voice shaking slightly.
"Hilda," Pete repeated. "What a charming name. You are new to our little town, are you not?"
"Yes, I just moved here."
"I thought I'd never seen you before. Get up, come closer."
Slowly the girl stood, but she didn't move any nearer to Pete. She seemed scared of him.
"Come, come," Pete said. "There's nothing to be afraid of."
That's what I was thinking, I thought. That's just old Pete. Why would anybody be afraid of him? He's a creep sometimes, it's true. I remembered the time he painted a white stripe down Chester's back because he wanted a pet skunk. But still...
"I'm not afraid," the girl said. "It's just..."
"Just what?"
Pete tilted his head to one side.
"I've heard about you. I've heard... things."
Pete chuckled.
"What sort of things?" he asked.
"About what goes on here."
Slowly, Pete moved toward the girl. She didn't move. When he was just inches away from her, he said,
"How lovely your neck is."
Well, I was surprised at that one, I can tell you. As far as I knew, Pete didn't like girls. He'd certainly never noticed their necks before, or said mushy things like that.
"So white," he went on. "So pure. So..."
He didn't finish. Instead, much to my amazement, he lunged for her neck and appeared to be biting it. Chester, Howie, and I gasped. The girl fell to the ground, and Pete, wiping his mouth with his arm, laughed like a maniac.
"I can't believe it," Chester muttered. "It's happened. It's really happened."
"What's happened, Pop?"
"Yeah, what?" I asked. "Pete finally likes girls?"
"No, you dimwit. He..."
"Shh. Listen." Toby came around from back of the house.
"Did you take care of the others?" Pete asked him.
"Yes, master, just as you told me to."
Just then, another kid came running up the street and into the yard. He, too, was wearing a black cape.
"Come on, let's go," he called out. "It's time. The others are waiting."
Pete and Toby jumped up and down, laughing.
"It's our time at last," Toby cried out gleefully. "Time for the vampires!"
"On to Castle Bernicula,"
Peter shouted, and they all broke out in demonic giggles.
"We've got to stop them," Chester said, his voice shaking with excitement. "It's happened, don't you see? Bernicula and his zombie vegetables have finally gotten to real human beings. I'm not surprised that it's our own Toby and Pete who are the ringleaders. I always knew they were too susceptible. All that television had to take its toll one day, and now, I can't believe it. Vampires! Come on, you two, we've got to get there and warn the others."
"Get where?" I asked.
"Where they've rounded everybody up."
"Gee," I said, "remember that crowd of people we saw earlier? Do you suppose..."
"Of course," Chester replied, cutting me off. "They've got them all in their power. Hurry, it's up to us to save what's left of Centerville."
Once again that day, I found myself racing down the street. I must admit that this time I was really worried. A drastic change had come over Toby and Pete. Were they gone forever? I thought as I hurried behind Chester. No more chocolate snacks at twilight. No more games of catch in the backyard. No more tummy rubs.
"Hey, Harold, Chester, come here, Howie."
I looked back and saw Toby calling us.
"Come on, you guys, where are you going?"
I hesitated for a moment. Maybe it was all a dream. Maybe if I went to them, they'd be just old Toby and old Pete, and everything would be the same. I whimpered, longing for things to go back to the way they were.
"Don't turn back, Harold," Chester cried out. "That's just what they want you to do. Don't be a fool. Keep moving. They'll turn you into a vampire, or a werewolf, or..."
"Oh!"
Howie yowled, throwing back his head. Chester shuddered. "Of course, in some cases, we may already be too late," he said.
"Sorry, Pop," Howie called out. "I just had to get that off my chest."
Everything became a blur as we ran faster and faster. Where we were headed, I didn't know, but what we were running from was clear.
"Hey, you guys, come here!" Toby called.
"Here, Harold! Here, Chester! Here, Howie!"
Pete chimed in. Chester is right, I thought. Bernicula really is a vampire. He really does have minion onions. And now he's got Toby and Pete, too. Who knows who else in our humble little town has fallen into his clutches?
We may be too late to save them all, but we'll save whomever we can, however we can. Watch out, Centerville. Here we come.
Chapter 7 Curse of the Vampires. On and on we ran, racing breathlessly past the post office, the Acme supermarket, the Starlight Lounge, and Bolarama. In the distance, I made out a throng of people moving toward an iron gate that stood ready to swallow them up into the yard of a long brick building. Castle Benicula, I thought, though I must say that even then the building didn't look too much like a castle anything. As we drew closer to the milling crowd, Chester cried out, "Mindless zombies, hypnotized, lost, hopeless. We'll save them, Harold. We're almost there. I can feel it." I glanced back to see that Toby and Pete and their gang of fiendish hoodlums were still on our tails. Faster, faster I went, dodging honking cars and wobbly bicycles whose riders called out words of encouragement and support like, "Hey, you stupid dog, watch where you're going." Howie's little legs scampered by as he shouted,
"Aren't we having fun, Uncle Harold? This is better than eating shoes."
Chester ran through the crowd and the iron gate. "This way," he called back to us. "Follow me." Howie and I bounded through the gate to find ourselves in the midst of a swarm of people milling about, shouting, laughing, carrying on. What a festive air, I thought, for people doomed to a fate worse than death. I thought no further then as I spotted Chester at the far end of the crowd. He was jumping onto a large platform on which stood a youngster who didn't seem to notice his arrival. Instead, the kid waved his hands in the air and called out above the heads of the crowd, "Here we are! We're all ready!" I glanced behind me and saw that he was shouting to Toby and Pete, who were leading the pack fast catching up with us. "Hurry!" Chester called to us. "Faster! Faster!" Through the crowd we raced madly, bumping into legs everywhere we went.
"Watch it!" someone cried. "Who let those animals in here?" shouted another. "Oops! Stop them! Catch them! Mad dogs!"
I looked up to see people lunging toward me. A look of fierce determination glinted in several pairs of eyes. Possessed, I thought, out to get us to join their vampire ranks. I jerked out of the way of their advances, shepherding Howie safely through. A fat man in a bright yellow shirt suddenly blocked our way.
"Here, doggy, come on, little pup," he said menacingly.
"Be careful," Chester warned. "Don't look him in the eye, or it's all over."
I darted through the man's legs. He fell forward, narrowly missing, squashing Howie, who fortunately moved to the side just in time. I crashed into a little kid, transplanting the ice cream cone he was eating from his fist to his forehead.
"Mommy!"
he screeched. I jumped up onto the platform, knocking over the kid who'd been calling to Toby and Pete.
"What the?"
he cried out in surprise as he picked himself up.
"Uncle Harold! Uncle Harold!"
Howie called. I dashed back to the platform's edge to pick Howie up with my teeth.
"Now what?"
I asked Chester, dropping Howie on the platform next to me. Chester looked around him.
"This must be their headquarters," he confided quietly. Then, taking a big breath, he screamed,
"Destroy! Demolish! Charge!"
I barked loudly as I dashed about, tumbling into chairs and tables, scattering a scatter rug, unearthing a plant, sending a cup and saucer flying. Howie tugged at the pants leg of the kid still standing on the platform.
"Cut it out!" the kid yelled, trying to shake Howie off. "What's with you, anyway?"
Chester jumped from one overturned object to another, emitting unearthly yowls as he went. In short, we made quite a scene. And it wasn't over yet. Just as I thought we'd done about as much damage as we could, I heard a loud creaking sound.
"Watch out!"
someone in the crowd yelled.
"It's falling! Move out of the way!"
The kid jerked his pants leg out of Howie's mouth and scrambled out of the way and over the edge of the platform.
"Move, Harold!" I heard Toby cry. "It's going to fall right on your..."
It was then that I glanced up and saw what looked like a wall falling right in my direction. Down it came, right toward me. I had enough time to notice a portrait hanging on the wall, and then, with a crash, the portrait was hanging on me. Pretty flimsy construction, I thought, as I surveyed the scene, and saw that the wall was nothing more than cloth stretched over some pieces of wood. No wonder it hadn't hurt when it had smashed over my head. I didn't have time to observe much else, as I heard Chester yelling, "Look over there! It's Mrs. Monroe! She's holding a giant white carrot! Undoubtedly the leader of the vampire vegetables! I've got to destroy it!" I watched as he raced through the crowd and leapt into the air just feet away from where Mrs. Monroe was standing. He smashed into the carrot she was holding in her hands. He must have jumped with a lot of force, because the carrot seemed to disintegrate before my eyes. It splattered into the air, all over the ground, and over Chester, who at the moment was sliding off the plate the stunned Mrs. Monroe still held in her hands. Just then Howie tugged at my hair.
"Uncle Harold,"
he said with great alarm in his voice.
"Yes? Ouch!"
"They're drowning Mr. Monroe. Look! He must have resisted, and now they're drowning him."
I looked past the crowd, past Mrs. Monroe and Chester, and saw that, sure enough, Mr. Monroe was in the process of being drowned. There he sat on a little seat above a pool of water, when suddenly the seat gave way and, splash, down he went.
"I'll save you!"
I barked. I dashed off the platform and through the crowd and, without thinking of what I was doing, heroic type that I am, jumped into the pool of water. Boy, was it cold! Even my teeth were shivering as I grabbed Mr. Monroe by his shirt collar and pulled him to the side. For some reason, he was laughing. Hysterical, I thought. The poor man's gone over the edge. But no, he seemed to be laughing at me. "It's all right, Harold," I heard him say. "No one is trying to hurt me. It's a game, just a game." Huh? Now I was really confused. What was going on here, anyway? I looked up to see other people laughing as well. Were they laughing at me? Mrs. Monroe came through the crowd as Mr. Monroe and I departed the pool. Someone handed Mr. Monroe a towel. I shook the water off as best I could, to the squeals of surprise of several bystanders. Mrs. Monroe didn't appear to be as amused as the other people. "What in the world's come over them?" she asked. Toby and Pete pushed their way through. Toby was carrying a bedraggled-looking Howie under his arm. Chester was suspended by the scruff of his neck from the hand of the irate Pete.
"They've ruined everything!" Pete cried.
"Ruined?" I thought. "We saved the day." "Didn't we?"
"Yeah, Mom," Toby whined. "Look what they did to our play."
Play? I turned my head and saw for the first time the sign hanging atop the platform. "Curse of the Vampires," it read. "A play by Toby and Peter Monroe, 1 o'clock today." I turned and glared at Chester. As best he could, in his awkward position, he shrugged.
"Yeah," Pete went on. "I think they've gone crazy or something. We were up at Kyle's house, practicing our parts, when all of a sudden the three of them jumped out from behind this bush and took off down the street. We called to them and everything, but they wouldn't come. We chased after them, but the closer we got, the faster they went. Until they got to school here, and, well, you see what they did. They knocked over the set and the walls and—"
"School?" "Don't worry," Mr. Monroe said, knocking water out of his ear. "We'll get the stage set up again in no time, and the play will go on as scheduled." Mrs. Monroe turned to a woman standing next to her and said apologetically,
"I'm sorry about your carrot cake. I'm sure it would have won first prize in the bake-off. It was so clever of you to bake it in the shape of a carrot and put that scrumptious-looking cream cheese frosting on it. I don't know what got into Chester."
"I don't know what got into Chester, Mom," said Pete, "but he sure got into that carrot cake."
A chuckle ran through the crowd.
"And Harold's acting weird, too," Toby said.
"Well," said Mr. Monroe, "I can guess what happened with our friend Harold. He must have thought I was drowning and tried to save me. You can't expect a dog to understand things like a dunk-the-teacher booth at a school carnival."
Dunk the teacher booth? Carnival, I thought. What's a carnival? I looked around me at the brightly colored streamers that festooned the school playground, the booths, the balloons, the clown who was at that moment walking by. So this is where everybody was headed. Zombies, indeed.
I'd say you have four unusual pets, said a man in the crowd, tapping Mrs. Monroe on the shoulder.
Mrs. Monroe just shook her head and sighed.
Yes, someone else said. Maybe you should have entered them all in the pet contest.
Chester jumped down from Pete's arms and ran over to me.
That reminds me, he said. We've got to find Benicula before he...
Howie cut him off with a sharp yip.
Look,
he cried, squirming out of Toby's armhold and jumping to the ground.
Over there on that table.
We looked up and saw a cage made to look like a castle. Castle Benicula, read a sign atop it. On the front was a big blue ribbon that proclaimed, First Prize, Most Unusual Pet in Centerville. And inside was none other than our long-lost furry friend, Benicula. We scurried over to the rabbit's cage and peered in. He was sleeping soundly. The sleep, as they say, of the innocent.
So that's where he's been, Howie whispered.
I glared at Chester.
Somebody goofed, I said. If you don't deserve that prize, nobody does.
Chester yawned. Then he smiled weakly at Howie and me.
Well, boys, he said, it's been quite a day, hasn't it?
I was about to place my paws around his neck when Mrs. Monroe came up behind us.
Phew, do you fellas smell, she said. Where have you been?
It's a long story, I thought. She called across the school playground to Mr. Monroe, who was on the platform helping some other people put the stage set back together.
Robert, she said, I'm going to take these guys home and give them a quick bath. They smell as if they've been to the town dump. I'll be back as soon as I can.
Hurry, Mom, Toby shouted. I don't want you to miss the play.
We walked single file behind Mrs. Monroe, our heads hanging, our tails drooping, all the way home. Well, Chester, I mumbled, now that we've made total fools of ourselves, what do you have to say?
A slight misinterpretation of the facts, he replied. Everyone's entitled to one slight misinterpretation of the facts in the course of a lifetime.
Suddenly, Howie said,
Psst, Uncle Harold, don't look now, but you're being watched.
I looked up and saw a large white cat hanging over the front porch railing of his home, his beady eyes following my every step. He hissed. I gulped.
Remember me?
He said as I passed.
Don't worry, Buster,
he went on, his eyes narrowing to slits.
You will remember me. One of these days, I'll give you something to remember me by.
I gulped again, wondering what it would be like never to leave home again.
Don't worry, Uncle Harold,
Howie said, apparently overhearing my throat muscles contract.
Snowball may or may not be serious in threatening you. After all, he could be just kitten.
I resisted the temptation to bounce Howie the rest of the way home.
Howie chortled. Get it, Uncle Harold? Just kitten. That's a cat joke. Wait till I tell Pop. I'll knock him dead.
Or vice versa, I thought. I sighed as I mulled over the possibilities fate held in store for me. Captive forever in a house with wise-cracking Howie and adventure-loving Chester, with squabbling Toby and Pete and a television set that's possessed, or free in the world where Snowball was waiting to rearrange my body hair. How complicated life had become for a dog who wanted only the simple pleasures, peace and quiet, and the occasional cream-filled chocolate cupcake. I appreciated anew the old expression, it's a dog's life. Chapter 8. Home is where the heart is. That evening, bathed, fed, and refreshed,
I felt life returning to a semblance of normalcy. I was curled up on the rug, contentedly chewing a recent copy of Architectural Digest, while nearby Howie and Chester were trying to help Toby and Pete solve a Rubik's Cube. Howie's idea of helping was to grab it with his teeth and race to the other side of the room before the boys could get it away from him. Time after time, they succeeded in retrieving it, however, until he finally tired of the game and began playing tug-of-war with Mr. Monroe's slipper. Unfortunately, Mr. Monroe's foot was still in residence in his slipper, so that didn't last long either. Benicula sat in his cage, staring out at the rest of us, and twitching his nose, which I guess is a rabbit's way of having fun, or at least passing the time. His first prize ribbon adorned his regular cage, Castle Benicula, I gathered, having been relegated to the garage or one of the boys' bedrooms. The Architectural Digest clamped in my jaws, lost its interest when Mrs. Monroe appeared suddenly at the kitchen door, carrying a plate of fudge. I ran to her side and begged shamelessly. "Well, hello, Harold. What do you want?" she said. "This isn't dog food, you know." "It is to this dog," I thought. Toby piped up. "He knows it's not dog food, Mom. Harold loves chocolate." "Really? What makes you say that?" I got a little nervous then, thinking that Toby was about to blow our late-night snack routine. I gave him a look, and he seemed to get the message. "Oh, I don't know," he replied with a shrug. "He just drools a lot whenever I'm eating a candy bar. Why don't you give him a piece and we'll find out if he likes it?" Toby winked at me. "I don't know. It might be bad for him," Mrs. Monroe said. I gazed up at the plate in her hands with an expression of desire usually found only in the pages of novels, with titles like Wretched Reckless Love or Forest Fire in the Timberland of My Heart. Mrs. Monroe smiled down at me. "Well, I guess one little piece of fudge once in a while never hurt anybody, now did it?" She lowered a piece to my quivering lips, and I was in instant heaven. The next hour or so passed peaceably enough as the Monroes recalled the day's events. Apparently, after our abrupt departure from the school carnival, everything had gone on as planned. Curse of the Vampires, though slightly delayed and redecorated, the portrait hanging on the wall was now of a man with a hole in his head, was a huge success. Mr. Monroe went back to his dunk-the-teacher booth, where things went, you might say, swimmingly. And Mrs. Monroe's friend's carrot cake, the one Chester had demolished in his service to mankind, won first prize in the bake-off, the first time in culinary history a cake has won an award posthumously. And now we were all back home, safe and sound from our various adventures. Well, safe, anyway. I'm not too sure how sound one could ever expect Chester to be. Later that night, after everyone had gone to bed, he confided in me that he was still convinced Benicula had gotten loose and gone on a rampage throughout the town. "Otherwise, how can you explain all those white vegetables? They had nothing to do with the school carnival," he said. "And where was Benicula, anyway? We know he wasn't in his cage in the living room last night." Howie dropped a bone he was carrying around the room and ran to Chester and me.
"I just remembered something Pete said to Mr. Monroe tonight."
"What's that?" Chester asked.
"He said it had been a good idea to put Benicula in his new cage, you know, the Castle Benicula one they made for the carnival, so that he could get used to it. He spent the night in it in the garage."
"So there you are," I said. "He couldn't have gotten out. He was safe in the garage all night, and..." Suddenly I gasped. "What is it, Harold?" Chester asked. "Mr. Monroe came running into the house this morning with the news that the garage door had been left open all night," I said. "So Benicula could have gotten out." "And could have, in fact, did, turn all those vegetables white. Let's hope we got them all, because it's night once again. Night. The time when the vampires come out to prey on the helpless, to attack, to drain their victims dry, to..." "All right," I said, "enough. Let's not get into this nonsense about a bunch of silly vegetables."
That's right, Howie said, his teeth chattering, because you're really scaring me.
Let's get some sleep, I suggested. It's been a long day.
Good idea, Howie said. Uncle Harold?
Yes, Howie.
May I curl up with you tonight? I'm a little nervous.
Why, certainly, I replied, as long as you have your pop's permission.
Pop?
Chester glared at both of us. Spare me your feeble attempts at comedy, Harold. Good night.
Good night, I said,
stretching out on the rug. Howie rolled up into a little ball along my belly, and in no time at all was fast asleep.
Good night, Benicula, I called out softly.
Benicula blinked at me, a look of peace and contentment upon his face. I was just about to drift off when I noticed Chester sit up suddenly in the armchair he'd chosen for his night's slumber.
What's that? He cried in a whisper.
What's what? I asked.
Coming from the floor, there under the floorboards. I can hear it going thump, thump, thump. Tear up the planks.
Have you lost your mind? I said. It's coming from under the sofa. Chester jumped off the chair and dashed to the sofa. With his paw, he pulled back the dust ruffle and batted a white object out from underneath.
Here, here, he said. It is the beating of this hideous heart.
Well, how'd that artichoke heart get there? I asked. Then, with a shrug, I turned to Chester and said,
Come on, Chester, let's get some sleep. But, Harold, it's almost midnight. Who knows what evil lurks?
Cut it out, Chester. I want to sleep. And that's just what I set out to do when moments later I heard it.
Thump. Thump. Thump.
My ears perked up. One eye popped open, then the other. I regarded the object lying just inches away from my nose.
Could it be? I wondered.
No, it was just Chester's imagination.
Thump, thump, thump. Still,
Chester, I whispered. My voice seemed to echo in the darkened room.
Hmm?
Chester replied wearily.
You wouldn't happen to have a toothpick, would you?
And now, a special commentary read for you by the author.
Hello, this is James Howe. I hope you've enjoyed listening to the story of Benicula. I'm asked all the time how I came up with the idea of a vampire rabbit, and I always wish I had a good answer. The truth is, I don't remember. Not exactly, anyway. It may have had its beginnings in the Vampire Legion, a club I co-founded with my best friends Terry Frost and Judy Cook when I was in the fifth grade. Membership, 3. I don't remember much about the Vampire Legion other than meeting one time in somebody's basement, Judy's, I think, where we turned off the lights, lit candles, and made weird faces at each other. We also published a newspaper called the Gory Gazette. I was the editor. Circulation, 3. But I suspect the real origins of Benicula would be traced to a later time, in the 1970s, when I was living with my wife Debbie in a small apartment in Brooklyn Heights. That's the part of Brooklyn right across the river from Manhattan, at the other end of the Brooklyn Bridge. Debbie and I met at Boston University, where we were studying to become actors, and married a year after graduating. We loved watching movies late at night. This was before the days of cable TV or videotapes or VCRs, when movies were shown on television all night long, starting at around 11:30. Debbie and I stayed up late many nights, watching all kinds of movies, the Marx Brothers, Sherlock Holmes, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, but our favorites were horror movies, especially ones about vampires. A lot of those movies were made cheaply, and they were pretty bad, so bad they were really funny. My guess is that my instinctive sense of parody, I was a big reader of Mad Magazine as a child after all, was inspired by all those funny vampire movies. I began to wonder, what is the silliest, least likely vampire I can imagine? The answer, for me at least, was a fluffy little bunny rabbit I named Count Benicula. Now, the idea for the character of Benicula was mine, but the idea of turning the character into a book came from Debbie's mother. When she heard I had a vampire rabbit living in my head, she said, "What a wonderful character for a children's book. Why don't you two try it?" Debbie and I did not have children of our own. We had never taught school. And although I had become an uncle several times over at a young age, it had been a while since either of us had been around kids. We didn't know the first thing about writing a children's book, but we both loved to write. I had been writing from the time I first learned how. My teachers always told me I was a good writer, and my mother always told me that's what I should be when I grew up. But I didn't want to be a writer. I wanted to be a jockey, until I learned I would be too tall. And then I wanted to be an actor. But I kept writing anyway, just because I loved doing it. Debbie didn't write as much as I did, but she was an amazing reader. She read an average of 10 to 20 books a week. Debbie had a greater need to read than I did, however. She was frequently ill, and when she was ill, books were her best companions. I can picture her now, stretched out on the sofa in that apartment at the top of the brownstone in Brooklyn Heights where Benicula began. She would have a box of tissues beside her, a cat curled up on her lap, we had two cats at the time, a book open in her hands, and there, always within easy reach, a stack of books waiting to be read. So Debbie brought a keen sense of literary style to our endeavor, and it was she, in fact, who penned the opening lines of the book. "I shall never forget the first time I laid these now tired old eyes on our visitor." What I brought to our endeavor, besides a talent for writing, was a sense of humor developed in a family where I had to make others laugh if I was going to keep up with three older brothers and a father who always, or so it seemed to me, had new jokes to tell. They were forever playing with words, twisting them cleverly or turning them into groan-inducing puns. I trooped off to the school library regularly to check out books of jokes and riddles so that I could arrive each night at the dinner table armed with new material. I served a tough apprenticeship, but the result was that when I sat down for the first time to write a book, it was hard for me not to be funny. Debbie and I laughed a lot as we wrote Benicula, and one of the lessons I learned about writing, looking back on it, was that it was important to write the book for ourselves, not some imaginary young reader out there. And we really were writing the book as much to entertain ourselves as to get it published, which, as far as we were concerned, would just be icing on the cake. Although the time spent writing the book was just a small part of our busy lives, it was a time we always looked forward to, because we knew we would end up laughing. A few months after we began writing, we found we needed to laugh more than we'd ever needed to in our lives. In the spring of 1977, when we were about midway through writing the book, Debbie began to experience worsening pain in her lower back, pain that had become almost crippling. No doctor was able to diagnose the problem. And then, on August 11th, the day before Debbie's 31st birthday, she was diagnosed with cancer. Debbie remained in the hospital for almost 2 months. In late September, she moved into her parents' apartment in the Riverdale section of the Bronx. A hospital bed was moved into her old bedroom, and after a time of shuttling back and forth between Brooklyn, where I lived, and Manhattan, where I worked, and the Bronx, where my heart was, I found someone to live in our apartment and take care of the cats. Then I, too, moved into my in-laws' home. At some point that fall, I typed up the 6 chapters we had written, and when Debbie was feeling up to it, we returned to telling each other the story of Benicula, the vampire rabbit. I can't place that moment, where it happened or when. In truth, I have no memory at all of writing the book from that time on. I trust that some of it was written in the hospital, some in the apartment in Riverdale, but I can't see us in my mind's eye. Can't connect the words on the pages to the hands that wrote them. The only connection I can make is to the sound of laughter. That I can hear. Cleansing laughter, washing away the taint of sickness and dread, releasing us to that blessed place where we had always been so happy and at home. The world of the imagination, of words and dreams unfettered by hard-hearted reality. By the time Debbie died on June 3, 1978, she was the co-author with me of two children's books, Benicula, A Rabbit Tale of Mystery, and Teddy Bear's Scrapbook. She wanted so badly to leave something of herself behind, and she did. To those who never knew her, she left Harold and Chester, and words, and laughter. She left her name on the cover of a book that has only grown in popularity since its publication. It is now being read by its first readers to children of their own. I have gone on to become just what my mother always said I should be, a writer. I've written numerous sequels to Benicula, along with many other books, and even though I have written every book since Benicula and Teddy Bear's Scrapbook by myself, I still have the good company of words. Words, with their power to create characters and new worlds, to light up the darkness, and in the face of impossibility, make anything seem possible. I hope you'll enjoy listening to the other books in this series, and that words will give you good company always, whether they're listened to, read, or written by you yourself. Oh, and one more thing. Keep laughing.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Benicula, A Rabbit Tale of Mystery, by Deborah and James Howe. This program was produced and directed by John Wager. Senior producer, Lewis Milgram. Text copyright 1979 by James Howe. Production copyright 1999, Random House, Inc. Holiday Inn by James Howe. This program was produced and directed by John Wager. Senior producer, Lewis Milgram. Text copyright 1982 by James Howe. Production copyright 2000, Random House, Inc. The Celery Stalks at Midnight by James Howe. This program was produced and directed by John Wager. Senior producer, Lewis Milgram. Text copyright 1983 by James Howe. Production copyright 2000, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible Kids hopes you have enjoyed this audiobook. For more like it, check out kids.audible.com.